are listening to a free version of Majority Report with Sam Steeder. To support this show and get another 15 minutes of daily program, go to majority.fm, please.
The Majority Report with Sam Steeder.
It is Thursday, July 19th, 2018. My name is Michael Brooks on a Michael Thursday, and this is the five-time award-winning Majority Report. We're broadcasting live steps from the industrially ravaged Gowanus Canal in the heartland of America, downtown Brooklyn, USA. On today's program, Jesse Helms. He's dead. He was evil. He was racist. He was authoritarian. He was cynical. He was dangerous. He was a thoroughly awful person who pioneered media to spread far-right propaganda and then become a powerful member of the United States Senate. In other words, he invented the modern Republican Party. We're talking about it with Nick Martin. He's a staff writer at Deadspin and for Splinter News, where he's writing a series, The State of the Nation, talking about how Jesse Helms invented the Republican Party. The Russians say that there is a verbal agreement that was made, and U.S. officials are scrambling to figure out what that verbal agreement was. Someone needs to make a meme of Sergei Lavrov, the Russian foreign minister's face, when he was leaving that meeting before the Trump-Putin press conference. The House GOP passes a member lauding ICE while Democrats withhold their votes. That's right, ICE, the kidnapping and extortion arm of the white supremacist Republican Party. Democrats make significant cut to caucus states in another clear aim at a Bernie Sanders insurgency. The Interior Watchdog has opened a probe to a land deal involving Interior Secretary Ryan Zinke. Could there be more corruption in the Trump administration? No.
Watch out, Scott.
Take a long look at what you're doing. And immigrant infants are too young to talk, are called in to defend themselves in court as part of the same kidnapping and extortion policies of the Trump administration. After 20 years war between Ethiopia and Eritrea, there is a new outbreak of peace and a aggressive diplomatic initiative between the two neighboring African countries. Haiti searching for a new government after mass protests against austerity and fuel strikes bring down a prime minister in that country last week. And pressure mounts as further legal options by Brazil's Worker Party for the political imprisonment of Lula da Silva while they question the entire judicial process in Brazil. And the fascist candidate Bolsonaro meets with the U.S. ambassador. All that and more on today's Majority Report. The gentlemen are in studio, and we're going to start with an interesting piece of sound. Do you remember when Republicans running for office, this is another sign of the sort of move from subtext to text of the Republican Party, they might get a question, say, from a earnest high school student or a, you know, nice young elementary school student that might say, like, hey, you know, I'm a little concerned, Mr. Republican politician, because I'm actually growing up and I would like my world to not resemble Blade Runner.
Gee, mister, are you sure now's the time to cut the EPA?
Yeah, like, golly gee, mister, it seems like all of those scientists up there think that climate change is real and might not be too good for my health or kids in other countries that might get flooded. And then the Republican would be like, young lady or young man, well, first, I want to say thank you for being out here today. And thank you for taking. Don't you feel confident about democracy when this young man talks or this young lady talks? And then they would go on to say, well, it sure is a complicated one. And God, of course, I'm not going to do anything about it because I'm literally a lab creation of the fossil fuel interests. But gosh darn it, good to see you out here today. Well, it's 2018, and we have a different Republican Party. And this is, not in terms of substance, but in terms of text to subtext to text, this is Republican gubernatorial candidate Scott Wagner. He's running for governor of Pennsylvania. And a young woman, by which I mean, I think like a high school student, is going to ask him why he is so retrograde and dangerous on climate. And he ain't going to respond with the usual pleasantries about appreciating young people being in the process. Forget that.
Change is an issue that needs to be addressed. But you have said that climate change is a result of people's body heat and are refusing to take action on the issue. Does this have anything to do with the $200,000 that you have taken from the fossil fuel industry?
Rose, you know what, I appreciate you being here. You're 18 years old, and you know, you're a little young and naive. But Rose, I appreciate being here. Are we here to elect a governor, or are we here to elect a scientist? Okay, I'm here to be the governor. Now, Rose, I understand and I appreciate, and I know the questions. But I have one for you, Rose. Climate change is important. We all hear about it. But Rose, in 2016, there was a story in the Wall Street Journal about sinkholes in Harrisburg, okay? And the story started out, a woman was in her home, she heard this huge crashing noise, and she opened up her door and went out, and there was a huge sinkhole that had developed in her street. So the Wall Street Journal wrote that article in 2013, and they talked, it was all about the city of Harrisburg, and how ancient and outdated the infrastructure was in the city of Harrisburg. And the story went on to say that when the city of Harrisburg has large rainfalls, which generate large amounts of stormwater, the sewage treatment plant cannot handle all the rainwater in the sewage. So they discharge raw sewage into the Susquehanna River. Now, you want to talk about that? You want to talk about climate change? I'm more interested in the sewage that's going in the Susquehanna River.
I like how he's like, first of all, listen, you dumb little bitch. I'm not trying to be the scientist. I'm trying to be the governor. Secondly, climate change, sure, yeah, whatever. Body heat's a big issue. Thirdly, here's another issue that I'm going to do absolutely nothing about as an austerity Republican. Infrastructure. And fourth, actually, those intensified rainstorms and issues like sewage going into the river because of both degraded infrastructure, which I support as an austerity Republican, and all evidence actually suggests that climate change actually does intensify things like storms. So I'm actually going to indirectly address your question again. That guy is a unbelievable scumbag, and look, I want, and I think he will. It's a very important gubernatorial race in Pennsylvania to reelect Governor Wolf. He's actually a pretty decent governor. And people, I mean, Pennsylvania is a crucial state to register and vote in and vote for Democrats across the board for a variety of reasons. But there's a certain part of me, the like poetic justice part of me, wants this guy to hold some nominal office that this young woman, as soon as she's old enough, can just run against him and beat him in a landslide. Because, yeah, she gave him a little bit of heat, and rightfully so, because he's a pawn of the fossil fuel industry. And to respond to her like that, it's such a level of crude stupid. I mean, isn't it disturbing even to people who maybe forget the merits of it, that it's like, oh, wow, somebody who's 15, 16 years old gave an articulate, important and informed question
about how you might be too interested in a topic to be neutral on it,
right? And his response was to be, I mean, look, condescending and moron is not a great combo. I get you're a little naive. Anyways, there was an article in the Wall Street Journal. Ever heard of that?
Yeah, so Scott Wagner.
What a scum.
His money comes from, he owns a waste management business called KBS Trucking. And that question, do we want to hire, or are we electing a governor or a scientist, right? Like, I don't think governorship should be run like a science.
No,
but I also
not.
Think that they shouldn't be run like a CEO either.
Especially not.
I would rather vote, just all things else being equal, I'd rather elect a scientist than a CEO.
Okay. Every single time, practically. Also, it reminds me of an old Onion headline where it was like something like, it was like chicken CEO, basically it was like CEO of like an agribusiness where like, you know, chickens are held in cages and tortured and defecate on each other, essentially, which is what all big, you know, farm agribusinesses are. Promises to take his same leadership methods to Washington. Like, he's like, I'm going to do for you what I've done for the chickens at all of my factories. That's exactly what you should think of every time you hear about CEO leadership. All right, guys, we're going to take a brief break. Yeah. We'll be right back. I think it was Bad Things.
Oh, yeah, yeah, you're right.
We're just curating the music in real time. There's no instrumental? All right, do a 3-6 Mafia instrumental. What the hell? Just, it's going to be great. Whatever it is, you know, whatever you do, just do it with passion. I miss the Wyatt Coke drop a lot, actually. I think that should be more in the mix. All right, we're going to be back in a minute with Nick Martin for Deadspin. Back to the Majority Report. Michael Brooks here. Joining us now is Nick Martin. He's a staff writer at Deadspin. He's author of the new series at Splinter News, State of the Nation. Nick, thanks so much for being with us.
No, thanks for having me, man.
So, Nick, you have a great piece, and people should read this piece. It's incredibly well written and researched. It will also make your stomach turn, called How Jesse Helms Invented the Republican Party. First, let's just start with the bio, the facts of the case. Who was Jesse Helms? Who is his dad? In some ways, maybe more to the point, as you established in this article. And what was his career trajectory? Because what you really show is that in addition to, obviously, I think everybody understood to the extent that they know who he was, that he was this retrograde bigot, segregationist, and so on. But he was also a pioneer of media, which has obviously always been harnessed by the far right in this country and the Republican Party, and also, you know, his father was a North Carolinian small town cop. So basically, every single negative social trend in one person. So maybe break that down for us.
Yeah, I mean, Jesse Helms, he's born in Monroe, North Carolina. It's a small town. I mean, even before the 90s, North Carolina was pretty easy. You had which were cities, I guess you'd call Charlotte and Raleigh, but the rest of it was either farming country, mountains, or small towns. And that's where you'd have, like, you know, factories and stuff like that. And that's where Jesse Helms grew up. It was obviously a segregated community. His dad was indeed a police chief as well as a fire chief in that community. And back in those days, that, I mean, even still, it holds a lot of power. And one of the things that I cite in the piece is that, his dad was not, the apple didn't fall too far from the tree. His dad was pretty routinely accused of physically abusing, black men and women in the community. And that's something that you can kind of tell rubbed off on Helms as he went through the rest of his life. From there, he always wanted to be a journalist in high school. That was what he said he wanted to do in his senior yearbook. And then he just kind of followed that career path. He first went to Wing It, and then he went Wing It University in North Carolina. Then he went to Wake Forest for a year. But he spent a lot of time working in Raleigh, doing the newspaper gigs, kind of learning the media machine from the inside. And so later on, after he worked on, some segregationist campaigns for a Senate and president, he took that and he was able to bring it back to North Carolina and eventually got a show at WRAL. And this is an important thing to understand, that, like, when I'm saying in the piece, I call it his show, it was a 5-minute editorial that would run every day. It's called Viewpoint. What that kind of was, I call it Fox News before it's Fox News, because you have to remember, this is a time when you had like 6 TV channels. My parents grew up in Eastern North Carolina, which is the main base, which was where his main base was located. And, that they grew up in the 70s and 80s, and that's what they had then. So you can imagine his show ran from 1960 to 1972, and he just really understood and developed an understanding of how to get people to line up with him, even though they might not necessarily be as extreme in their views as him. Mm-hmm. He made those views seem reasonable, I think, to people in a South that was resistant to change. Even North Carolina kind of has this reputation, or had this reputation, of being a kind of a progressive beacon in the South. And it's kind of tough to square that sometimes when you actually go back and look at who they were producing in terms of like the Helmses and the people that actually weren't just state leaders, but national leaders in this kind of new old South conservatism, I guess is the best way to put it.
So how did how did he make the pivot from journalism? How did he start? Because as you said, this TV show, these commentaries are really important. When did he start kind of formally stepping into this commentary role? And then maybe if you don't, just do that first. How did that shift start to happen?
Yeah, I mean, he had always been interested in doing that kind of stuff. I don't think he had in his younger days, like, he worked with the Willis Smith campaign, and he did a lot of behind the scenes ad work while he just had kind of fronted as being this journalist. And then on the backside, he was actually writing the ads and helping make sure they got, prime placement on the radio show he was doing. So it's just something that's kind of always been there for him. And he's just, as he went along in his career, people started to notice that he was good at that, and he just had more opportunities. So I would say a big thing that is not, even for people who know Jesse Helms and know the show Viewpoint, a big thing I would point out to would be his time running the Bankers Association, North Carolina Bankers Association. He did that for a number of years before he got his big show. And he had like a column there that was called By Jesse Helms. And he would just basically write takes, and he turned it into the biggest banking trade publication in the nation while he ran it, because they were just these anti-regulatory takes that he would dish out. And, it was always there. I just think it was a matter of him kind of climbing that professional ladder to then be able to get to a spot where he could just reel them off every day.
Well, this is a really important point, and this is where, your argument, and you make it, I think you're absolutely right. The synthesis between the interests of the corporate sector, banking as an example, and racism, segregation, cultural white supremacy, xenophobia, those are the twin pillars of the modern Republican Party. And what's interesting is that he So not only, I mean, people know, and we will continue to elaborate, but as I say, I think to the extent people are aware of who Jesse Helms is, it was the fact that, you know, first of all, that the North Carolina kept sending him to the Senate through the aughts, right? And that you had this guy who was a, you know, overt, you know, racist and apartheid advocate and so on. But that this other distinction is interesting, that part – and so on one hand, you say, okay, yes, he comes out of the old, you know, Dixiecrat, Jim Crow, segregationist tradition. Those guys were Democrats. Then they shifted and became Republicans with the passage of the Civil Rights Act and the Voting Rights Act in the 60s. So that's one part of the narrative. At the same time, some of those Dixiecrats – and to be clear, I mean, when they weren't defending – you know, indentured servitude and a permanent racial underclass, which also did affect a lot of poor white people as well, because obviously things like poll taxes did affect, you know, poor whites, even though it wasn't designed to target them in the same way. But that being said, right, you could find people who were you know, segregationists and just despicable and retrograde on race, but they were they might have had some economic populist tendencies. They might have been supportive of, you know, New Deal programs for whites, essentially.
Yep.
Jesse Helms, how does the synthesis start where he pivots from the populism of economics and bridges the plutocracy economics with racism? Because that's, as I say, that is Republicanism now. How does he start to bridge those things? And how does maybe bring us more towards the 70s and 80s as his influence really spans over the Republican Party, so that you can't understand someone like Ronald Reagan without understanding Jesse Helms?
Yeah, and that's something I didn't link to it but I didn't quote this part, but like when he died, Ross Douthat wrote that if Jesse Helms is his death is anything, it's like something to remember that we should have more Ronald Reagans and fewer Jesse Helms. And that's just completely ignoring that you cannot have Reagan without Helms. Like, Helms was the guy kind of out front of the Republican Party when nobody really wanted to touch him. And then once he started making money, once people started understanding that his campaign methods worked well, then everybody was, or not everybody, but a lot of people, and especially behind closed doors, were very buddy-buddy with Helms as he progressed. Even somebody like Joe Biden came to his funeral.
Right.
And so I think that what you're talking about, he never really... There was never a time where he didn't have those kinds of tendencies in terms of his economic policy, the way that he approached it. Now, listen, a lot of his policy stuff through the 70s and 80s was more just being an oppositionist, just being somebody that would muck up the Senate with amendments and filibusters. But this stuff, I mean, the stuff about the way that, I mean, I've quoted in there, the Atwater approach, it's like, that was Helms's thing the entire time. I mean, he went farther to the edge than I think a lot of other people did, and then it kind of allowed Republicans to obscure it by, you know, he was one of the leading people against, like, force busting and stuff like that.
Right.
But it allowed them to obscure the economic policies to a point that, like, they were able, in a PR sense, to remove race from those conversations when it was still very clearly there. So for Helms, I'm not sure that he ever deviated from that path. It was more of a growing frustration within the Democratic Party that he felt. He always kind of saw the federal government as this very intrusive, kind of obnoxious figure in American life. I mean, he grew up, North Carolina is a state, you touched on this earlier. You just said about the stuff about how you might have a segregationist, but they might be more of have populist economics.
Right.
Governor W. Kerr Scott, who was governor during the 1950 election that I opened the piece
with.
Right. He's the guy who appointed Frank Porter Graham, the liberal UNC president. Frank Porter Graham was also a segregationist, but he also was a huge New Deal person because he grew up on farms in eastern North Carolina, and what the New Deal provided was subsidies for small family farmers they would kind of set a price floor
right,
so that they wouldn't fluctuate year to year. And so Helms was against those. Helms was against labor unions. Helms, like all this stuff that might have even helped poor whites, like Helms was against from basically the beginning. And you can read through his old interviews, and a place like the Southern Oral History Program has a really great that I linked to it in the piece. Just read that. If you want to understand Helms's, where he's coming from economically, that's the best document because it's his words. And he's the same guy. Like, he's the same guy throughout. And I think the Republican Party adapted to him more than him adapting to the Republican Party. That's why he left the Democratic Party.
Definitely. So what we have here, and let's get to his election and then his Senate career in a second. But really what you have is, so again, the fundamentals, segregationism, and then also we could, you know, just call it basically Christian white male identity politics, essentially. Mm-hmm. And that's the kind of base motive of the Republican Party. And that's the, you know, that's the red meat. That's Trump. That's how you get anybody that isn't ultra affluent to have any interest in a Republican message. Then there's basically, I mean, I'm already anticipating some of the whining I'm going to hear about this, but it's libertarian. And some libertarians are nicer about it. And they say, oh, well, you know, no, of course you don't need a Civil Rights Act or government intervention because, you know, it's bad for business and you'll just magically take care of itself. Of course, like, actually, it was great for businesses to literally have a part of the whole population that wouldn't compete with you is a beautiful business advantage in terms of reality. And also, yeah, as by the just, again, observed reality that this went on for decades and decades and it didn't change because of some magical economic formula, that obviously was the case. But that being said, I mean, Jesse Helms was, he was a segregationist and a racist, but the same, but essentially the same objection of like, I don't want the government in here saying that, you know, I can't put sewage in the water or I need to treat somebody, yeah, with dignity and respect. It's the same, you know, state, local rights, libertarian thing, which is really just either, you know, an umbrella for bigotry or business interests. And then the third thing maybe we'll get to is also a global role of militarism. You know, by the time we get to the 80s, maybe we got to pretend a touch in the United States. But man, they've really got something great going on in imprisoning, you know, the ANC in South Africa and having an apartheid, mm-hmm, state. So we got to support them. And then, of course, the guy gets on the Foreign Relations Committee and is called Senator No. And his whole job is to promote war and destroy the UN. So that starts to become the third pillar of Republicanism. There's Christian white identity politics. There's policy sets that favor only business and then kind of libertarian mythology that go with it. And then there's a whole world to lay to waste as well. And that, of course, also loops again with supporting arms and defense contractors and oil companies. And, you know, and obviously in varying degrees, all of these policies have, of course, been embraced by many Democrats. But they are distilled and in essence in the Republican Party. So how does Jesse Helms get to the Senate and how do those kind of three wheels start turning in his Senate career? And how does he bring, along with Lee Atwater and Reagan and the Bushes, how do they, yeah, start embracing? And then, of course, the Gingrich Revolution and obviously today, I mean, Donald Trump, it's a no-brainer. How does the party become that of him?
Yeah, that's like the most interesting thing to me. And you have to understand how he kind of built up to that point through media, because it was his manipulation might not be the right word, but that's the word that comes to mind. But like, he really did know how to get a message across, whether it was through a newspaper ad or a radio ad or at a campaign rally. I mean, the stuff you see about like Trump heckling the media and like the bullpens, yep, like that comes from his campaign trail. He's the one who, I don't know if he started that, but he popularized it. And so he took all of that into this 1972 campaign. You had a senator in North Carolina, Everett B. Jordan, who was kind of an establishment Dem, had been there for a while, and had deep pockets. And he decided, well, he didn't decide not to run. He lost his primary to Nick Galifianakis, the guy who's the uncle of this guy in The Hangover and behind Between Two Ferns. So Ben Helms sees this guy that's the son of Greek immigrants, is a three-term congressman. So you're looking at an easier target for somebody that's selling xenophobia. Yep. It's a lot easier than selling it to like the old, like trying to sell it against like the old white Democrat.
Right. Right.
And so, you know, we'll ignore that Galifianakis was like born and raised in North Carolina and a Marine and all that stuff. So,
naturally.
Yeah, we'll ignore all that.
Yeah, naturally. Yeah. Right. Yeah.
Helms just swept through, used the what would become a staple, which was like this last minute kind of racist attack ad. And it was never all those. He did that multiple times throughout his career. They were never, we would consider them overtly racist now, but by 1972 standards, it was not overtly racist to mm-hmm. them, I guess, no. Or it was just like okay racist. But yeah, he rolled out a campaign that was like, he's Jesse Helms, he's one of us, and he won by 120,000 votes. And then he spends, so 1972, you get Reagan in 1980. So in those 8 years, he's a junior senator. He doesn't have a ton of power, but he really, really goes to work on the Senate rule book. Like, he understands everything about how things get through the Senate, how he and a group of a couple other senators started railing against voice votes, which are not counted. They're just like A's or no's or whatever, mm-hmm. and or I's and no's. And they rail against that so they can get more people's vote on the record so that they can then kind of put these amendments. Another prong of it was Helms would do a ton of amendments that everybody knew weren't going to pass, but he wanted people to vote on them so that he could then create ad campaigns based off the votes on like stuff like the most famous one is he filibustered the Martin Luther King Day national holiday.
Right.
So did John McCain and Orrin Hatch and yep. other people that are still with us. But he just kind of used that as a, like, he was kind of the stick in the mud a little bit for those first few years, but he did that. And in doing so, he gained this huge national audience because they didn't just stick to North Carolina in their ad campaigns. They spread out across the nation. And this was another big thing. It was development of how he, these mailers they would send out. And it was kind of, I just write it in the piece, he's like an inverse Bernie Sanders. Like all of his campaign donations were like really small. It was grassroots. Ted Cruz, actually his first political contribution was to Jesse Helms. And
Ted Cruz really $10. Is, you know, in a world that includes Donald Trump, that includes like, you know, the head of ISIS, I'm still putting my money on Ted Cruz as the worst person on the planet.
He's
up there.
Does not disappoint. Helms uses these kind of innovations. I read about the three prongs he kind of used media-wise to get that across. But what he was also doing when he's doing all that is you had a very stark shift, even though it might not seem that way in reflection, but you had a very stark shift amongst the National Democratic Party around the mid-60s, early 70s, in terms of, you know, they were just trying to align themselves to, it was slow, it took a long time, but they were trying to align themselves with more minority voters and more women voters.
Right.
And so what happened was that Helms just kind of became the poster boy for saying no to all of that. Like, he was the guy that would just, anything was too much, a step too far to him. And if you can be that guy and you can really sell it, but you can't be, it's a tough medium. Like, there's a sweet spot to play in that he really nailed, which was you can kind of be this total jerk, but as long as you can sell those actions, like, those actions might be really detrimental to these communities, but as long as you kind of stand up there and you have a nice Southern drawl and you shake people's hands and, you know, people are able to say, well, you know, you can't say much about Jesse, but you knew where he stood. Like, that's how you win. That, and he did it. He did it perfectly. Like, it's impressive in a really it's impressive in a really depressing way. But yeah, I mean, he was just kind of stood on the edge.
And that also feeds. Yeah, I think if I recall correctly, I think there's this picture of him like beaming at Kofi Annan, who is like, you know, the very charismatic, probably the last UN Secretary General, and he was destroyed by the Bush administration basically because he did sort of in a very, very gentle and legally appropriate manner, you know, oppose the invasion of Iraq. But there was a period of time where he was kind of probably, certainly in an American context, probably the most politically relevant and kind of liked and publicly acknowledged UN Secretary General, at least in the sort of modern era. And, you know, and he was from, I believe he's from Ghana, and he was a very, you know, he was just a very appealing guy. And I remember seeing a picture of Jesse Helms, you know, kind of beaming at him and giving him a big shake and a smile. And I think that that sort of speaks to what you're talking about. But it also, the other theme that kind of emerged in your article, and Joe Biden's been getting into trouble with this a few times because he also had some comment about, you know, kind of like, I think also Strom Thurmond, who of course was this other, horrific arch segregationist that stayed in the Senate past any point of, you know, basic public shame and embarrassment in this case for the state of South Carolina. But and to be clear, you know, and I'm not saying this to be fair because I think the sentiment is just ludicrous, but Biden is not saying you got to understand their policy perspectives. He's doing it in the same spirit that, you know, the New York Times editorial is having a conniption about somebody disrupting Sarah Huckabee Sanders, you know, feeding or meal or whatever. So that, you know, it's the civility nonsense. And I think the other thing that comes through your piece is it isn't this was even dangerous then too. And again, it's not, of course, look, the guy's in the Senate. It's a, you know, whatever, you got to work with him. You're not going to, you know, spit on Jesse Helms in the Senate. But the idea that somebody could be so fundamentally immoral and so fundamentally out of the bounds of any type of human decency and progress, specifically in this case with regards to race, and that you could just sort of say like, oh yeah, but now we go home and, or, you know, we go have a drink. It's like, no, you can't. Like, this guy isn't on the team. And that's a fundamental problem to treat people that are, you know, American apartheidists as just being people you can disagree with. It's something more fundamental.
I mean, Strom Thurmond, I'm pretty sure Goldwater and even George Wallace, like, these are all guys that, like, listen, they had really terrible effects in terms of what they set out to achieve with their policies and just their rhetoric. But I want to say Goldwater's the only one I'm not sure of there, but I know that Wallace and Thurmond, like, they both later in life, they apologized and like kind of recanted how hard they went against the civil rights bills. Helms never did that. You can look in his writings. You can read his books. I wouldn't recommend it, but you can read.
No, we could just read your article. No need to suffer through that.
That was never him. He was never going to apologize for being that person. And for whatever reason, that just made people like him more. I don't quite understand it.
But don't we, in the age of Trump, kind of understand it, though? Don't we?
Yeah, exactly. That's what I meant. That's what kind of what I meant. Like, I understand it now, but when, like, I think when you're just first going over this stuff, it is, you just have that kind of reaction of like, well, why would any Democrat or any person that wants to seem progressive, much less be progressive, even like honor this guy, or why would you say to lower the flags on the state? Like, you have to do that in part. Some of that stuff I get, you have to do if you're a North Carolina governor or whatever, and you have to lower the state's flags. But like, it's just living this middle ground, this extension, this road to this, like, I mean, you summed it up well. It was a pretty, by progressive standards, immoral man in terms of how he viewed the world, how he viewed people. It was through a very, very small window. And, you know, if you say that it's okay to sit down with that person and just have a beer with that person, you have to draw a line somewhere. And I think that you're right. Like, we understand the effects of this now, in a post 2016 world, in the same way that I think that historians and people who wrote about this started to understand Helms probably after like 1984. Once you had more Republican, the GOP kind of built up, I think people started to it took a little bit longer, for people to understand just what had happened, to the Senate, by the time it was like 12 years or 14 years of him being there. Whereas with Trump, I think it's a little bit more, a little faster, a little bit, and we have this history to draw on. It is simpler.
I mean, I think that, and also, you know, in my view, the whole lesson could have been concluded even just in Ronald Reagan in 1980 announcing his presidential run in a city where civil rights workers were murdered and talking about states' rights. I mean, that confirms the Helm thesis right there, and the fact that there's no daylight in the Republican Party. And even George W. Bush in 2000 running the type of brand. I mean, that was the peak of let's try to rebrand ourselves and the compassionate conservatism and speaking Spanish and all this stuff, still wouldn't say, and granted, this is, you know, it's symbolic and less important than policy, but nonetheless, still wouldn't say that you needed to remove the, you know, the battle flag off of the South Carolina State House. And again, all of the compassionate conservatism and speaking Spanish was also symbolic, and it showed you where, you know, those were the lines that would not be moved in the Republican Party. That being said, as a final thought, and we basically, do you think that, we're definitely in the age of Trump, obviously. Trump embodies all of the things that we talked about in terms of, you know, mass populist appeals through media, a plutocratic economic agenda, racism, xenophobia, bigotry, you know, just basic cruelty. What is an effective way? I mean, how is this resisted and fought effectively? Or is it just, you know, the sort of first building block to just be really real that Trump is not something that comes out of nowhere? He's a continuation. And in fact, this is what the Republican Party is.
Yeah, I mean, I think that the same thing that I just kind of did with Helms, people will do with people, not specifically Trump, but they'll do it with people around Trump in a few years from now. In terms of re-examining just how influential they might have been to like allow this party to form into the creature that it is. You can go back the story of Trump. I mean, you can go back probably pre-recession, but if you really want to start, look at like the elections of 2010 across state legislatures. The North Carolina GOP, look at what happened, like look how fast they rose right after we got the first, in North Carolina you had the first woman to be elected governor, and same year that you had the first black man to be elected president in Obama. Look at the reaction to that. I think that we let ourselves be surprised by this because you can kind of go on cruise control for a little bit. But all of this stuff does, like there's always a little thread or a dot to connect your yarn to. It's not quite as random as it seems. At least that's my takeaway from working on this project. I mean, not everything is a straight line, but you can definitely see where influence is. Like Jesse Helms did not create the GOP in the sense that it's the party that it is today, but he molded it and invented it in the sense that like it allowed it to grow in like one specific direction, and we just happened to get it a little bit more interesting of a candidate. I guess. That's like,
so you're basically saying it, like, Jesse Helms never said, you know, my daughter's incredibly sexy.
He never. I can't. I don't,
right, right. Yeah.
I don't think he ever said that. But
he was never. Jesse Helms was never on Wendy Williams' show and said, you know, perhaps if my daughter wasn't my daughter.
No.
There was no.
What would be the? I love talking about this stuff. Helms is just an interesting guy, man. And I think that the whole, if there's one takeaway I want people to take away from the piece, is that yeah, he was all of his edges. He was the racist, the homophobe, the xenophobe, everything, every word you can throw at him, he was.
Yep.
But he was also just really good at his job, which was getting elected yep. and getting in front of people.
And being a brilliant propagandist from the beginning.
Yeah, and yep. it's like, you can't ignore how he got there. If you ignore how he got there and you just focus on what he did when he was there, I think that then you're just kind of ignoring a future path just to be used for good, just to be used for something positive with our society. But just in terms of the guy who got all the people elected to the North Carolina GOP said that he just took the people three blocks down the street. He took their plan and he just flipped it and just inserted their ideology into it. Helms's path is unique, and I don't think it'll be recreated anytime soon. But at the same time, in terms of what he was able to do, I wish more Democrats would hold up the Senate and that they would, at least have the brass to do stuff like fight for abolishing ICE and stuff like that.
Absolutely.
But,
absolutely.
You get that kind of counterpart, you're fighting an unfair battle.
Well, that's absolutely right. I agree with you 100%. It's a really good piece. It's linked to on the website, How Jesse Helms Invented the Republican Party. It's part of a whole series that's at Splinter News called State of the Nation. Nick Martin's also a staff writer at Deadspin. Great writer. Really appreciate your time, Nick. Thanks so much for doing this.
Yeah, man. Thanks for having me on. Really appreciate it.
My pleasure. Talk to you soon. Okay, folks. We are going to go to the fun half. Majority, Matt played some. You guys played a little bit of footage of that Reagan speech, right? Yeah.
Yeah, I hadn't seen that before. I was looking to see if there was the full thing, but I can't find it. There's audio of it, but.
Yeah, I mean, look, Ronald Reagan was 100% part of this. Ronald Reagan's presidency was white identity backlash politics. It was slightly more complicated time. I'll tell you what. Ronald Reagan vetoed sanctions against apartheid South Africa. And in the later in his administration, and granted it was already because he was taking a pummeling because of things like Iran-Contra, but the Senate overrode his veto. And that included a chunk of Republican votes. That would never happen today. So, things were a little bit more dynamic then. And there were, there might have actually been what could be described as sort of Republican centrists, which obviously don't exist today. But at the same time, in 1988, everybody's Poppy Bush, so moderate. Poppy Bush let Lee Atwater run one of the most racist, pure Helms campaign in 1988. And also at the same time, this is when you're getting the rise of Rush Limbaugh and right-wing, eliminationist authoritarian radio. And then by the time you hit 1994 and Gingrich and the Contract of America, you're there. The lobbyists were writing the legislation for dismantling the EPA, for destroying the safety net. The welfare bill that Bill Clinton signed into law in 1995 was one of the most cruel, savage attacks and absolutely encoded in racism. Bernie Sanders, to his everlasting credit, when he voted against that bill, not only talked about how immoral it was to poor people across the board, he did also specifically call out the racism of the rhetoric of welfare. And don't forget, at this time, we're dealing with an incoherent and lethargic Democratic Party with some absolute sights of corporate financial capital interests that are blocking momentum. And there's also some real sights of progress. And on the other hand, at least the social baseline has moved to the Democratic Party. Because if you read about the 90s, it wasn't just that you had an insurgent, successful, xenophobic, racist Republican Party. You had a Democratic Party and consultants around the Democratic Party who were quite willing to not only, forget hashtag abolish ICE. More like, what about her own ice bill?
Yeah, every time you see somebody say, today's GOP is doing something that not even Reagan would do.
Not true.
That's a point. Well, it's a point about how politics works and not what's in these people's hearts.
Precisely.
Because if Reagan could do any of this shit, he would have. He did everything he could. It's you work with the conditions you have.
Precisely. And so, you know, and I think it, and I do think it's a good lesson with Democrats to disaggregate these things and see, again, where there's just intransigence, corruption, failure, stagnation, where there's actually really positive momentum and potential, and where things have already been gained. Because I'm telling you, it wasn't just, of course, it was policy and capital that had the Democratic Party become fully third way in the Clinton era and deregulate Wall Street and slash the safety net and sign a massive expansion of the prison industrial complex. But specifically with regards to things like welfare and prison policies, that was a very specific embrace and willingness to, and the Defense of Marriage Act, to triangulate and play to and try to placate all sorts of racism, xenophobia, which in the modern context, not because of the moral courage of Chuck Schumer or whoever, is rhetorically unacceptable from Democratic Party leaders. And that's because of the base and the conditions Matt's talking about. And that's an accomplishment and a very important one to be mindful of. It's also a reflection that, frankly, this is where representation is really important. It's also a reflection of, and my God, it's so piddling, but, you know, Cory Booker in the caucus, in the Senate, Kamala Harris in the Senate, a lot, Tammy Baldwin, a lot more women in the Senate. That also has an effect in terms of like, no, I'm literally like the group that you want to scapegoat is literally in the lunch meeting right now. Makes a real discernible and material difference. So become a member of the Majority Report today. majority.fm/become a member. You can go to justcoffee.coop for fair trade tea, coffee, or chocolate. Use the Majority Report code. In previous episodes, I'm sure there's still deals going for things like the Quip deal or the New Yorker.
By the way, shout out New Yorker. The union was recognized today.
Shout out New Yorker. Oh, that's awesome. Shofar for the new New Yorker staff union. That's excellent. Shout out. Keep spreading the word. Our YouTube channel is blowing up. Fortunately and unfortunately, obviously, it means a lot more. Absolute morons are calling the show.
It's an exponential, I feel like, increase in certain areas.
Blessing and a curse.
I will say I prefer, although I'm done, like if racist old man calls, well, actually, I have some questions for racist old man, particularly about his dating life. So I might be on there. I might give him 30 seconds if he answers any of those questions, because I am curious about what kind of sad experience could lead to this type of perspective and voice. But on the other hand, I have more respect for I'm a total scum, and let me just come straight out with it, with the Ben Shapiro style of like, we can all acknowledge it as Japanese people and then white people and black people on an IQ scale, but then I had a point to make about democracy. That does not fly with me.
Flies with Mark Duplass.
Zing. So anyways, keep spreading the word for the Majority Report Nation, the Majority Report Militia. On TMBS, we had a great time with Matt Taibbi in studio. We went deep into Russia, the zombie idea of democratic centrism. We even did, in peak Taibbi, we did a little bit of Thomas Friedman dunking, which was just like living out, like that was almost like, you know, that was like a college vision coming to, like, how cool would it be to have some beers and make fun of Thomas Friedman with Matt Taibbi? It actually happened on Tuesday. That was a great show. Of course, for patrons, there's the post-game content where we do a lot of It's somewhat similar to this, but the clips are actually usually a bit more international in focus. We do random Alex Jones. It's really funny. We do sketches. We do games. It's a little bit more structured, but similar to the Fun Half. And then, of course, there's the Illicit Histories and Idea Primer Histories. Become a patron today of the Michael Brooks Show at patreon.com/TMBS, patreon.com/TMBS. Also, for TMBS, we have about, now it's 200, I just checked before the show, it's 289 iTunes reviews. We are at a really high rating. We're a 5-star rating. Thank you. Please keep spreading those because new people actually do discover the show organically that way through iTunes. And that goes for all of these shows, Majority Report, Literary Hangover, Antifada, Michael Brooks Show. The latest Michael Brooks Show review is 1-star, and it says he has a personal vendetta against Elon Musk, which was one of the funniest things I've ever read in my life.
And accurate.
And totally accurate. I have a highly personalized vendetta against Elon Musk. So what I'm asking is, could there be a handful of new 5-star reviews for TMBS that lead with, I too have a personal vendetta against Elon Musk? And they're sort of hybrid reviews where we talk about Elon Musk's sociopathy nonsense and maybe, more importantly, his silly cult. And then also you talk about how high quality TMBS is and entertaining and a great political Marxist education and global education and so on and so forth. Thank you. That is my request. Matt, what's going on at Literary Hangover?
This Saturday, Young Goodman Brown, one of the early short stories by Nathaniel Hawthorne about a young Puritan who goes into the woods and gets disillusioned after seeing many powerful people in society doing satanic things.
That's interesting.
It's actually a very interesting story. It's Stephen King's favorite Nathaniel Hawthorne story. It's interesting because he sees like priests and people from society in there and he gets very disillusioned.
It's
a very heavy allegory. I think of it as sort of like, let's say you're a young leftist and you saw the DNC emails and you thought like, this is the most corrupt thing in the world and nothing matters anymore.
Right.
Young Goodman Brown sort of reacts to that after his experience in the forest.
That's really interesting. Okay. So, and tell all the people, as always, how they can...
Oh, yeah. So, it's on all the places you can get podcasts. It's also at Literary Hangover on YouTube and patreon.com/literaryhangover if you want to support me.
Oh, I also forgot. What is the name of the YouTube channel we're launching in a couple of days for TMBS?
Is it TMBS TV?
I think we're doing TMBS TV. Be on the lookout for an announcement on that. And unfortunately, I know a lot of people subscribe to me on YouTube where it's literally just like, but we're doing a different, there's a couple thousand people there. There'll be a new address. Make sure to get over there to get the TMBS content on YouTube when it starts coming out and really start seeding that. I mean, there's going to be a lot of different things, but you'll have a lot of content to share with your free exchange of ideas friends.
We want to create an arsenal for the anti-intellectual dark web campaign.
Indeed. On the Antifada, I don't know if the new show has dropped yet, but there was one. It sounded very fun.
Yeah, I think maybe today, Jamie was saying.
Yeah, maybe today. It's going to be a cult deprogramming with a former Muskite, I believe Grimes cover, Karaoke by Jamie. And I think on a recent one, if I recall correctly, I think they talked to somebody who was involved in the New York or union campaign. Yeah. So also check out The Antifada on Patreon and The Antifada on iTunes. We will be right back on The Fun Half. Thanks, everybody.
Competition would start kicking in. Filling that out sounds somewhat invidious. We don't really have time to clean up the mess.
to help with connectivity.
The era of the pajama boy is over.
This is so deep.
Tomorrow's news today.
Make sure you do it well and you do it with passion.
So I think both those parts, no matter what, no matter where you are, I don't care if you're in a clean state.
I feel proud of myself about that.